Please pull up a seat and wind down. With your sojourn on Rokinshima a pleasant one, the Witch of Truth has invited you to a tea party. We hope you choose to attend.
Party.
My name is Courtney, the Witch of Video Games, blessed with the pronouns she/her.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And these are my very notable guests.
Hi.
My name is Jess, my pronouns are they, them. I don't believe Courtney anymore when she says she's going to edit things out in post because she didn't edit out my secret cough in episode 26.
The little Easter egg for you all to go back.
It seems really deliberate.
I don't remember doing that.
Because it literally starts with like, okay, and then I'm like, I'm going to use this opportunity to do a cough. And you're like, I'll edit that out. And then that's just left in.
So it seems really
deliberate. It's great.
It was not intentional.
We're professional editors and everything we do is intentional. Just so you know.
Yeah, there is not a better edited podcast than Hidden Tea Party. Don't quote me on that.
Hi, my name is Rowan. My pronouns are they, them. We did some maths recently. We figured out the age gap between Jess and I is the same as the age gap between George and Shannon. I've decided that's all I'm going to say on that matter. The listener can try and guess how old we are.
Yeah. This came up because I'm wearing my sixth form Leavers hoodie currently. Yes.
For the audio listeners.
So which one's the younger one?
Yeah. Who's baby?
Who is baby? Write in.
Who is baby?
There'll be a poll on this episode. Which one's baby?
Yes.
Who's baby?
Who's baby? We might have already mentioned it, but that's a reward for
sharp-haired listeners.
Yeah, if we have listened to it and we've forgotten because you've been binging the episodes and we've been doing this for like over half a year, then good for you and you'll know.
Hi, you were binging the episodes? Godspeed. How far through are you? Are you binging this like a year in the future and there's a massive backlog?
Are you binging this 3 years in the future and the apocalypse has happened?
Are you binging this 9 years in the future after being thrown off a cliff?
Are you binging this 10 years in the future and we're now covering Higurashi?
No!
Oh, no! We're still going to be doing this in 10 years.
It's still going to be doing Mako only in 10 years.
We'll have only gotten to Higurashi in 10 years. Ace Attorney is that long.
Oh, I was thinking we do Ace Attorney and then we do, like, Pokemon or something.
Another seminal piece of media that I have not seen or interacted with at all.
What, Pokemon?
I said Pokemon as a joke, but now I feel like we should.
I've never played a Pokemon game. The closest I got to was I downloaded Pokemon Go for, like, that one summer. But I barely used it. Only with my friends.
Rowan, I'm speaking directly into your ear now. I am going to make you play a Pokemon game.
I mean, that's
whether
not too bad.
Whether on pod or not, I guess.
Yeah, I just want to see how Rowan reacts to little Blorbos.
I don't know how we play a Pokemon game on the podcast.
Me neither.
Stay tuned, maybe.
There's not really much, like... I love me some Pokemon games, but I would say there aren't many that I would say have, like, a story that you can analyze in a podcast format.
Unless it was, like, one episode for the whole game.
Yeah, it could be, like, Black and White had some characters in it that developed.
Oh, yeah, for everyone... one of the reasons that, like, that me and Rowan have said that Courtney has controversial takes on media is that Black and White are her favourite Pokemon games.
They're not my favourites.
Not anymore?
I like them a lot, though. No, my favourite like Pokemon game... My favourite Pokemon game is either HeartGold or Sun and Moon.
Okay.
I like both of those a lot.
I
always flip-flop on which one I like more. They both have flaws, but, like, how good they are balances out the flaws. Black and White are very good, though.
I think I would like Pokemon, but it's just so dense to get into, having never experienced it before. Like, you need to have been playing Pokemon.
I got into it when I was 6.
What I would say is that I played a lot of Pokemon, and I discovered recently that I actually know nothing about it, and I have still managed to complete some of the
games.
That's
incredible.
I have apparently retained none of the knowledge that I should have done while playing any of the games.
What is dense about Pokemon? It's there's like just... rock, paper, scissors for babies.
It's there's rock, paper, scissors, so much... but there's 18 more of them, and I only know the rock, paper, and the scissors.
This is the thing. I'm like, there's so much like lore. There's so many Pokemon. There's so many games. It's
what
like
lore is there? I'm confused about where you got this idea that there's Pokemon lore.
But basically, the way that you play Pokemon is you overlevel your team and then you hit everything in one hit, and it doesn't matter what type everything is. People are going to hate me for this, but that's the only way I can play Pokemon because I don't know how to do it.
I'm like, this is a fandom you need to have been in since you were like 6 years old so that you can have takes on every gen of Pokemon. Otherwise, it's like really hard to get into. And I respect people who have the time and energy to do so, but I'm out here reading Umen Echo. Like,
you don't need to have played every gen. You don't. That is a myth.
Yeah, you don't.
That is a myth.
I haven't.
Yeah. I guess all the Pokemon appreciation I see is like a sign of Pokemon from each gen or something. I'm like, there's so many.
Each game is very self-contained. You don't need to look. Like, if I was recommending you Kingdom Hearts, my favorite game of all time right now, then that would be a different story, because that game does have a lot of lore, and a lot of the lore revolves around how powerful Donald Duck is at any given point in time.
Miserable. We're going to probably cut all of this out, so should we move on?
Yeah, let's move on. This is probably getting cut. I say, having not cut out the secret part.
Yeah.
This is 7 minutes of Pokemon Discord.
Yeah, I know, like, this is all about Pokemon, it's not the right game.
And we actually have quite a lot to discuss, there's a lot that happens. This is a meaty reading.
Let's
After
go.
After some pretty chill readings, this is pretty meaty. So,
tell us what the reading is, Courtney.
We read up from chapter 9, Self-Reliance, to the end of chapter 11, The Fate of Those Who Do Not Fight. Let's find out what some fates are. Mm-hmm. We begin with a lovely little scene with our ace detective, Erica Ferrudo, and her furniture, Delanor A. Knox. Erica laments the fact that she has been set up to be at a disadvantage compared to the last game.
Yes.
Her room is not next to the cousin's room.
It's on the other end of the hall.
And also, Battler has made it so that every piece of tape in the house is not sticky enough to be used to guarantee perfect seals.
Battler has cast a spell of unsticky your tape.
I really appreciated that Battler was like, your last victory was annoying and petty. If you're gonna win this time round, you have to do it through actual detective work. Yeah. You're being a little meta gaming bitch.
Yeah. And I she's like, well, I guess I don't have to scramble around in the cold on the outside of the buildings this time. I'm like, yeah.
Also, yeah, you actually have to be a detective, you cunt.
Also love the fact that she has a duct tape sprite.
Yeah!
Like, she has a sprite of her holding duct tape like that, and I'm now like, that's incredible. That was, like, for a second, like, of that, like, why did you bother doing that? But also, where's her chopstick sprite?
Where is her chopstick sprite? That's what we're all saying.
You're so right.
I love the Erica tape sprite a lot.
Yeah.
So, then Delano's like, was pretty fucked up how you bullied that 9-year-old. And Erica's like, ooh, I'm an intellectual rapist. I did it because it makes me feel good. And Delano's like,
no.
Didn't get those vibes, bestie. I felt more like, you know, you were doing it out of, like, you know,
a bad feeling.
Yeah, like bad vibes. And then Erica dispenses some backstory.
Like to dwell briefly on the fact that we have a 17-year-old saying that she's going to, quote, intellectually rape a 9-year-old. I just don't want to gloss past that quite so quickly. Just going to highlight that. Going to sit with that for a second. Anyway, so we get some Erica backstory.
Yeah.
it's just bad mojo. The optics are vile.
Yeah, so basically they're in this position because Erica, having not got, like, because she can't listen at the wall all night like a creepo, and because she can't make any steals, she's got nothing to do, apparently, because that's the only things you do as a detective. So Delana's like, I guess we'll talk to her instead.
Yeah.
they play
but
check.
Yeah, and it's sort of like, yeah, why do you hate magic, Erica? Like, it's like there's some pain there, there's some backstory. And then Erica just kind of turns around on the bed and starts saying, I love you, to the wall. Which is really confusing for a while.
Erica kind of does, like, a recital of stuff that happened in her last relationship.
Yeah. She's like, I found mud on his shoes, he folded napkins wrong, the toilet seat was left down. And I'm like, come on, buddy.
There are so many lists of evidence that she believes that he was cheating on her.
Yeah, it kind of, that's what it solidifies into, basically, like, evidence that, she had evidence that she loved somebody, but she also had lots of evidence that he was cheating on her.
And he was like, his response was like, don't you trust me? Why are you being so accusatory?
Yeah, like, I'll leave you if you don't trust me. And it was interesting here because Erica says, like, her quote is, like, without love, it can't be seen is rubbish. She says, because of love, you end up seeing things that don't exist. And I was interested in this because I don't actually know how this backstory is being played. Like, I read it first as being like, oh, is Erica now, like, is this Erica as a victim of gaslighting and emotional abuse, having a boyfriend who's cheating on her and is consistently telling her that despite what she's seeing, that she should trust him? Or is this a story where he's not cheating on her at all, but she's so paranoid because she's massively insecure and jealous that she's seeing evidence where there isn't any?
So that basically comes down to, I don't know, how much love you have for Erica, in a way.
Exactly, yeah. It's, and like, I think in a way I kind of decided it doesn't really matter, because either way it's about how Erica is made unhappy by the fact that she doesn't know the truth.
And I think it is helped by the fact that we never get the truth.
Yeah.
I think that actually helped. So this is not really a point that's ever revisited. We're not going to find out what happens with Erica's ex-boyfriend, whether she was right or not. That's not the point. It's about Erica's own attitudes towards truth.
Mm. Yeah. And it's about how she can't know the truth. Because there is no red truth in the human world. There's only two blue truths that can go against each other.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why she doesn't like love or magic so much, because they indicate you can't prove love with the red.
Yeah. Interesting here. So the Erica, after the blue truth battle, Erica becomes Burncastle's piece and gets all of her blue truths elevated to red truths, which I think is like an interesting like mechanic of how which world works that I don't have. I think this is interesting to note, but I don't have much explanation. But then Delina says, even before you became Lady Burncastle's piece, you were truly splendid wielder of the blue truth. However, Lady Erica, humans are only allowed to use the blue truth. The only thing that can counter blue truth is red truth, and humans are not allowed to use the red truth. In that case, how should your opponent have shown his truth? And Erica responds, who knows? Maybe he should have used that gold truth or whatever, which is supposed to be stronger than the red truth at times. And I'm like, what's the gold truth that should have been used?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because the gold truth's about the rules of the game board, and presumably there aren't rules of the game board in the actual human world, because it's...
So,
yeah.
Okay, so when I explained gold truth, I didn't give, like, the full, like,
okay.
I gave what I interpreted it to be when I was reading it for the first time. So it's not, that's not necessarily what it is.
Okay. Mm. We haven't had much information about what it is.
Yeah. The other thing with the gold truth is Erica doesn't know what it is either.
Right.
Erica is just guessing because she was told last episode that it's sometimes stronger than the red truth. But the real thing is that Erica can't, had already decided that this was over, like, long before she actually confronted
her. Yeah, because she basically forces Delaina to be like, okay, I'm going to be me and you're going to be my ex-boyfriend and we're going to fight this out as if it was a witch duel. And they both, and Erica's like, I have 84 blue truths that say you're cheating on me. And Delaina's like, I've got 6 that I love you. And Erica's like, well, if it was purely numbers, I'd win. But also, like, we can't check if any of those are actually true. So what do we do now?
Because it's like if it was a blue truth versus blue truth numbers, which is how it ends up, it's like the side with the most wins. But she still hasn't managed to disprove the 6 points that he loves her.
She can't disprove them. And then that's where she uses. She's like, well, then I'm gonna now that I'm a witch, I'm gonna get them elevated to red truth, and then I'll be able to counter.
Yeah.
It's
a very, as I said, it's like Erica's own, like, how rigid she is about the game rules and truth is something that's actively hurting her personal life.
Yeah.
It's an interesting one as well, because, like, the question Delana asked her at the beginning of this is, why do you hate magic? And she's not really talked about magic in this, which is interesting, because I thought, like, this, for me, like, this is more of an Erica is anti-lying and anti-not being able to know the truth kind of thing.
Yeah.
And maybe, like, anti-love for, like, warping what the truth is and stuff. But I guess if you're doing, like, it is possible that we're doing a magic equals love in this story kind of thing.
I think they're definitely allied concepts.
Yeah, like, the way magic is used in this series is a way of enhancing something for someone you love, or shielding someone you love from a harmful truth.
Most of the times people have said without love it can't be seen. What they mean is without love the magic can't be seen.
Yes, I think that this is the point here. It's like, magic is the agglomeration of a bunch of blue truths to, like, create a new, like, witch truth or magic. And what Erica did here was, like, agglomerate 84 blue truths that this person was cheating on her. And no matter whether or not he actually was, she created a magical version where a witch truth where he was cheating on her, and then it didn't matter. It didn't matter what his truth was.
She's basically like, if it's not in red, it doesn't matter. Because I've learned that the only things that will not cause me pain are things that are in red.
I think this is what makes her such a good foil to the protagonists of the series, is the fact that she is so focused on dispassionately proving magic, and she's not really interested in the why of why someone would use magic, because it's not something you can, like, you can't prove that someone loves someone.
Yeah.
And so much magic in this series is wrapped around love, and she doesn't see love as evidence because it can't be proved.
Mm.
So she's having a great time in this game, which is very love-themed, as we are finding out.
Yeah.
So shall we move on to a little scene with our good friend George?
I called him with a typo in my notes this time, Groger.
Groger. Groger the Mighty. Famed pyromancer.
So, we get a scene of George telling his mother that he is engaged to Shannon. Naturally, she's not pleased by this.
No.
She tries to, like, phrase it to George in a way where she's like, don't worry, I'm not mad at Shannon, I'm just think you're throwing your life away.
Ugh. Yeah, she's just like, oh no, baby, you don't know what's good for you, I'll fix it, I'll get you someone good. Shannon's nice, but she's not for you.
And George aptly points out that the reason why she cares about this is actually because she's worried about her reputation and not because she actually wants what's best for him.
And money, also.
And money. And doesn't actually want what's best for him.
Because, if he married a rich family, that would solve some of their financial issues.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is assuming that all other rich families are, like, completely fine and don't have the same money problems as the Yusharomias, which I'm like, buddy.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of media about rich people is how they're actually, like, they have loads of, like, investment and stuff, but no actual money.
Which is really weird, because in real life, billionaires just hoard wealth and have loads of disposable income, and this is, like, completely untrue, but we can't have propaganda that, like, slights capitalism.
I also love the bit in this where, like, Ava's like, you just want to have sex with her. Oh, no, she's like, I bet it's because you've had sex with her, haven't you? And she's got pregnant and then she's forcing you into this. And George is like, no, I don't believe in premarital sex. And I'm like, of course you fucking don't. That's such a George.
Such a George thing.
And, like, it's such a George thing. I mean, like, in this instance, I'm really glad.
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
but also,
it makes
I'm like,
sense. We've already had the law that when Shannon and George went on their date, they slept in separate rooms.
Yeah, so. Like...
I'm completely willing to believe that this is something that Shannon has decided. And, like, Shannon's
abstinence
like, I don't think we should
president.
Have sex before marriage. I think we shouldn't do this. Like, I do not want to fuck you, George. Put it off for as long as
I mean,
possible,
yeah.
And then
if
and
she's
then he's
just
like,
using him to get off the island and stop being a servant, then this is a perfect way to do that, because then she doesn't have to sleep with him first.
Yeah, like, and I'm like, girl boss Shannon. So
pop off, sis.
While it is very on brand for George to feel like this, I'm completely willing to believe that this is a conceit that Shannon has made up in order to stop George from sleeping with her.
So, George is like, you're not my mother, you're like a trial that I'm trying to overcome, I'm trying to separate myself from you.
And she's like, whoa!
And then Ava freaks out and turns into Ava Beatrice.
Yes.
She's bad.
I also like this bit because, like, George is standing there in the rain being like, no, mother, you're just a trial. You're not my mum right now, you're just a trial. But the way he's doing it is like, they've animated his sprite really oddly in this bit where he's like got this weird, very sideways smirk and he's talking only out of like one side of his mouth. And it just, I think it's supposed to be him looking disgusted, but it just looks really weird.
It's so
it
good.
Weird.
I took
it's
so
my favorite
many screenshots.
It is fantastic. Episode cover art material right there.
We're never going to use my actual art at this rate.
No.
Ava Beatrice wraps George up in essentially a bag made of red truth web.
Yeah.
And starts, like,
get in my bag, George.
Repeatedly.
So I was confused by this because last time the red truth actually meant red truth, whereas this time she's not actually using any red. So I was like, what is Erica Beatrice's power set? Like, what's going on
Ava
here?
Ava Beatrice.
Yeah, let's not put an Erica Beatrice in the game. Oh, God.
So, I think this is just, like, an authorial flourish from Battler. Remember, he is the one writing the events.
Yeah, this is what her magic looks like, probably, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, this is just a form of her magic. This is, by the way, Ava Beatrice's finisher in the fighting game.
Yeah, this makes sense.
I'd forgotten there was a fighting game.
She wraps you in like a web bag and then just smacks you like on each side like a few times. Pretty cool.
So yeah, this was a difficult scene for me because George is the sympathetic character in this scene in the fact that obviously like his mum shouldn't be trying to control who he marries for her own gain and stuff like this, but I'm also like, I'm not fucking rooting for George.
Not Grogu.
That's the problem. Umineko's doing the parental abuse stuff again, which is important to the themes. However, that does mean we have to think about George.
So at this point I was just like, yes, hurt each other.
I think the novel wants you to be rooting for Shannon and George. The problem is I'm not.
Yeah. Well, I don't know whether, like, I don't know, I would love if this novel turns round right at the end and, like, just destroys the Shannon and George thing and being like, actually, like, we weren't rooting for this. Shannon actually thinks it's really fucked up and is just using
it
as a thing. Because I'd love that because that would make it all a bit easier to stomach.
At this point, I do think it wants you to be rooting for them, though.
Yeah.
I think it is nice to get more explanation on why George is like this.
Yeah, so...
Yeah.
We get a lot of stuff about George's upbringing here.
It makes sense, this explains a lot about why he's controlling, for instance.
Yeah, why he's, and the pressures he's felt, and why he feels like he has to live his life a certain way.
Ava Beatrice is talking about, like, the decisions they made about George's schooling, and she's like, oh my god, it was so hard to, like, do this, like, parent-child schooling stuff, and also, like, we had to drive you to cram school or whatever, and I'm like, come on, buddy, that is basic
parenting. Yeah.
You have chose, like, you chose to have a child, and you chose to put this child in cram school or whatever, like, you are just doing your duty.
And also, you chose to push this child who, like, didn't seem super academically inclined to make them really, really, like, high-flying and stuff.
You do not owe your parents anything for them bringing you up. Like, that is, like, they decided to be a parent. Them doing parenting thing, providing you food and shelter, and, like, educating you and stuff, like, you don't owe them anything for that.
Ava sees George as an investment.
She does.
Rushed to get pregnant when Natsuhi couldn't. Ava has wanted the headship for years and sees George being head as, like,
the way to get
the
it.
Best way she can get that. Yeah. So she, when she's making these decisions and talking about these decisions, she doesn't see George as a person.
Yeah.
She's seeing him as something she's invested in.
Yeah, and that comes across really in this scene as well, because, like, especially her being Ava Beatrice, like, Ava Beatrice is, like, her ambition, basically, that of becoming the head and not being able to do that so herself, and the frustration at all of that. This anger at him that he's not doing, playing the part that she's basically set out for him.
It's messed up.
It is.
All throughout all this conversation about George's schooling, Ava keeps coming up with these, what George is saying, calling aphorisms, which is like little sayings. And the reason why Ava is doing them is because they're quote-unquote British. So I have them here. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty common one that I have heard. Don't buy your child a fishing rod. Go fishing with him.
Not heard it. Kind of.
Decent advice.
It's kind of like a teach a man to fish. Like,
yeah.
Kind of thing.
Yeah, but like, maybe not. I think, because like, teach a man to fish, he'll eat for the rest of his life, is like, you give somebody something and they're satisfied once, you teach somebody something and they can provide for themselves. This is like, instead of just hoping that they will learn themselves, you should go and try and actively teach them the thing. And she takes
it's
this
more about supervision, that one.
Yeah. Don't criticize your child's friends, criticize their actions, right? That's another British saying.
Is it?
Like, hate, love the sinner, hate the sin? Like, I've never heard this. And then another British phrase, to wrap a child in blessings is the greatest education of all, which is just complete bullshit and I've never heard.
It doesn't mean anything.
Like, boil your child and they will come out a brat. My reaction to this information was, like, mostly the Hatsune Miku, oh, no, Hatsune Miku does not talk to British people. The only pound I'm looking for is me pounding your mom. That was my main feelings. But also, like, this is Ava's, like, thing that she's taken from the British, like, education system, not like, oh, yeah, so we should, like, pressure schools to over-intake students and overtax teachers in order to fight for funding, or like, nah, we should like penalize less like rich areas by making the schools worse in there to like widen the economic divide, or like, nah, it's fine actually that people can pay to go to better schools. Like, I would have thought Ava would have loved these things about the British education system, but now she's just like fishing rods.
She's like,
come on, buddy.
You have to remember, this is the British education system in the 80s, so, you know.
Yeah, and all of those problems still existed in the 80s.
I
did my research, like, pre-episode. It might not have been Michael Gove's fault, but
like,
Margaret Thatcher was there.
you have to remember, you You could still do Mice and Men for a level. I don't know if you could.
fucking British education system in the 80s is the, like, influx of Section 28. Like, Margaret Thatcher brought Section 28 in the 80s. Like, the thing Ava, like, should be taken away from this is, like, don't talk about gay people. Like, that's...
I think it's less about the British education system, and I think it's more about British education principles.
I took from this that basically Ava was entirely more interested in sounding like she knew what she was talking about than doing any research whatsoever. Yeah. Because she didn't care about actually having good schooling principles. She cared about making George what she wanted. But agreed. If you have some pithy phrases to tell him, then it sounds more credible, doesn't it?
That's fair. That's a very astute interpretation, and I really hope
I don't know whether that's true.
I was going to say, I really hope it's true. God.
I think it's a throwaway bit that Ryukishi put in to sound interesting. What do I know?
I think it probably is, and it fucking sucks. I'm like, buddy's never heard of the Socratic method. This dude has never done any research into British education. He just believes that, like...
I would rather that he put focus into other bits of this episode than the throwaway pseudo-intellectual fight between George and his mother. Yeah,
but it is funnier to talk about this.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't even write those down because I just skimmed past them. I was like, I don't know why this is even in the game.
I went to the Let's Play and Control F British. It's like, yes.
Yeah, this is a prime cutout content for the episode.
Alternative.
this is the most research I've done for the episode, you bitch.
That's really funny.
I'm just thinking, like, this is not the takeaway I had from this reading at all. It was like, Ava Beatrice knows nothing about the British education system.
It's a really funny bit. And also, I get to talk about how much I hate Britain.
I'm going
to
make a Ava Beatrice knows nothing about the British school system meme and put it on Tumblr, so if you take this out of the podcast, that won't make any sense.
I was fully gonna send you the Hatsune Miku, oh no, Hatsune Miku does not talk to British people videos for you to, like, input over my audio.
Choose to focus on sometimes is wild to me. Like, before this episode, Rowan put in the Discord, like, I have so many takes on the British public school system, and I was like, I have no idea what this reference is. I was like, no,
it's not what Ryukishi was thinking about. I don't think he was like, let's research the British education system in the 80s. I don't think he even researched the British education system now.
It's like... just hilarious. Okay, I need a peek behind the curtain for the listeners. When I am reading Umineko, there is a part in the back of my mind which is like, what's gonna make good content? So, like, sometimes I will look and I'm like, oh yeah, I can pop off about this because I've got niche knowledge about the British education system in the 80s, and they're gonna fucking hate it. And then I'm like, haha. Also, hating British people is funny.
Yes. Also, like, we're gonna ask Ryukishi about what his thoughts were behind this, and he's gonna hang his head and go, I don't actually know anything about Britain. And we're going to be like, good for you, honestly.
Like, this is a shit country. If you're going to, like, depict it as bad, you should do it properly and criticize it for the reasons it's deserved. Like, there are genuine reasons why the British education system is bad, which could have been weaponized here, which would have been so good.
That's very Anglocentric of you. I don't think we should force foreign countries to have to learn about Britain.
And I'm just saying that, like, there's some really interesting things that go on here, and instead of writing 7 different anime girls, he could have done, like, a tiny Google.
I think after colonialism, the world deserves to know nothing about Britain. Treat Britain like you do the continent of Africa, and just pretend it's, like, a monolith of posh people.
Fuck, actually that's a based take. I'm stealing that take, holy shit. I take it back. You should cut out everything I've just said. No one should know anything about Britain. real praxis talk, like, knowing about something is the best way to criticize it. One of the reasons I'm using my platform to talk about how much I hate capitalism and nonsense.
Yeah, but I'm just like, you know what, Write whatever made up shit you want about Britain. I don't care.
Yeah.
Britain would be right at home in this novel. It's about posh people and nonsense. And true. Tea.
True. George starts fighting back with martial arts and kills Ava.
Yeah, and that was the point. I was again like, I'm like, George is just doing exactly the same thing he did in his fight with Gap, which is get tossed around a bit and hurt a lot. Yay! And then, but it actually be really awesome and use martial arts and win. And I was like,
hey, at least George lost in the fight against Gap.
Yeah, I didn't like the fact that he won, but, like, also I did, and also, but yeah, what he actually does, though, to win is he uses his horrible little legs to do, like, a force kick that basically punches Ava Beatrice's heart straight out the back of her chest, even though it doesn't actually connect.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll be honest with you, they started fighting, and I was like, control button.
Just play the fighting game. Pit them against each other in the fighting game for the same experience.
I also didn't like... So, like, one of the things Ava Beatrice keeps doing in this scene is, like, she keeps talking about how, like, George isn't a... Like, she basically says, you know, George isn't a person yet. He's still... I'm still making him. He's still in my womb. And she talks about her womb all the time, and it's really weird.
She brings up her amniotic fluid.
It's horrible. And I'm like, she sounds like J.K. Rowling. She sounds like a cis woman transphobe who's like, womb, man. And I'm like, please stop talking about your womb. Goddamn. God. But then she dies.
I don't mind a good womb metaphor, like, when it's done properly, but I think you're right here, like, it's like, come on, buddy, this isn't the time.
Just
this is
saying,
far
get
too
back
bloodborne.
In my womb 3 times in a row, I don't think also classifies as a womb metaphor. That's
no, this is definitely,
people.
Like, bloodborne womb discourse, rather than, like, something more interestingly done.
Yeah. Yeah, so... Yeah.
Gap shows up to disappear Ava's body.
Yeah, George specifically calls Gap to do that.
Yeah.
Which is funny because it's the parallel between their last fight and whatever.
It's cute.
And we go back to the demon's room and we get the reveal that this has all been part of the love game. And to show their dedication of their love... each of the people in the game has to murder someone.
Yes.
Yeah, on the game board. Which,
yeah.
And Shannon's like, ooh, yes, brave George killed his mother. And I'm like, please, please, Shannon, just run. So George was aware in that he wasn't killing his real mum. He was killing a game board piece of his mum. But even still, like, he experienced it as real.
So is this, like, meta world George now?
Yeah, this is kind like Metal World George. Yeah.
Which I guess this is crewmate chat George? This is in the middle. It's not full meta, but it's also not on game board.
Yeah, so I'm like, is there a game piece George that's like somewhere else during this scene? Or is this just dead ass George has killed Ava?
Because what I'm imagining this to be a parallel as is, you know how in episode 4 when Kinzo got all of the servants together and then, like, got Beatrice to kill them all. Like, but then they all went to... Then they were all kind of put in different places and there was presumably a completely different human explanation for who killed who. That's kind of what I'm seeing this as. So, like, especially because Ava's body isn't outside, it's being put in the second floor bedroom. Like, I imagine there's a piece George somewhere who may or may not have had anything to do with this. The conversation might not have happened, like, any of, like, all of this might be fabricated. Which is why I'm excited to get to the part where we do find the bodies and alibis for people and where they were and stuff, because I'd be interested to see how much of this we can completely discount.
One thing I think is gonna be interesting is, like, the method of death, I think, will be different as well.
Yeah.
Particularly for, the next... fight that we get, because that's like a very particular method of death, and then the person specifically says, like, make this body look differently, we want it identifiable, and I'm like, oh, okay, this is interesting.
Yeah, I also think it's interesting that this is, they point out that this is very similar to the trial that was given for the headship in episode 4, where it was like you prove
But
your
this time,
strength by killing various different people, but
yeah.
this is you prove your love by killing someone.
Yeah, you have to kill one person, not your whole family,
I
so it's
wonder
different.
if these things are similar, if the qualities that one must embody to become the head are similar.
Possibly.
So, we then move to our next fight, which is Jessica versus
Yes.
Kyrie.
I looked at this and I was like, why would you choose Kyrie?
So basically, Jessica's like, doesn't know who to kill. Unlike George, she doesn't have a grand plan. So she just sort of wanders around until she bumps into someone, and she bumps into Kyrie.
Yeah, the hosts, Zephyr and Pervert, talk about like a roulette wheel, and they're like, you can continue spinning the roulette wheel. And she's like, nah, I might as well kill Kyrie. And I'm like, buddy, you've just accidentally
You've
stumbled
chosen
across an
them.
area that is so high level. Like,
Yeah,
buddy.
I was like, there are people I would choose to fight if I was one on one with them. Kyrie is not one of them.
No. Not at
And
all.
we get some more Kyrie backstory. This is
Oh
expanding on some
boy.
of the stuff we got in episode 3. Kyrie talks about Asumu and how he was like, she Rudolph's always been popular with women. So Kyrie stood out from the crowd by positioning herself more as Rudolph's business partner, focusing more on her intellect and less on her body. However, Asumu, according to Kyrie, instead weaponized her lack of intellect and used that as a way of sort of being an easy person for Rudolph to talk to,
Yeah.
someone who's not complicated.
Yeah, Kyrie
Whether
kind
this
of.
is true or not is, it's all from Kyrie's
Yeah,
perspective.
Kyrie says, like, it's about lack of intellect, but then she basically goes on to say that what Asumu was actually doing was providing emotional support.
Yeah, this
And,
is extreme
like.
pick me behavior from Kyrie. She's fully like, she was so stupid and she just listened to his feelings all the time and it was so
And she
horrible. Like,
supported him
she's
and said
so
nice things to
dumb.
him. And I was like, By the way, this conversation is happening because Jessica's basically hesitating. And so Kyrie is like, I don't know, what are you here for? And Jessica, like, kind of says, like, basically, I'm in love, but I have to fuck someone over if I want my love to work. And I don't know what to do. So Kyrie is telling this story to be like, this
Yeah.
is what you should do. You should fuck over people. Because if you don't, Asumu will get to marry the guy you love instead.
And you'll wait 18 years of
Yeah.
jealousy. This is hilarious to me because, like, can you imagine being at like family Christmas or something, and like your niece comes up to you and is like, "Hey, auntie, like I've just, and you know, you're quite clever. I've seen you like boss chess previously. You run the business. Like, can we talk about like, can I have some advice?" And you fully are like, "I had plans to murder someone."
Oh yeah, we're gonna get into that now. So, Kyrie is like, and then there was a miracle after Rudolph and Asumu got married, and Jessica's like, oh, because like she died, right? And then Kyrie is like, no, she was always gonna die. I was going to kill her, but I had a sword picked out and everything.
Yeah.
The miracle was that she died of illness, so I didn't have to get my hands dirty.
Yeah, and Jessica's just standing there like, what the fuck? Because I'm like, Kyrie, you should not admit this to someone who did, first of all, did not ask. Secondly, is a child, and also is the cousin of your stepson. Who is currently in the mansion, who you're just telling this kid you were gonna murder his mother if she didn't die anyway. I'm like, what? Yeah, so like she just goes off on all of this basically, and kind of yeah,
Yeah.
she talks again about how like, you know, she had the stillborn baby and Asumu had the had Battler. But like Kyrie hadn't wanted to reveal the pregnancy to Rudolph because she thought it would undermine the whole business partner thing she was setting up. But Asumu told him straight away. So like by the time they were having the babies, Rudolph and Asumu were already married. And she was like, oh, I didn't see her as a threat, so I completely, like, gave up my chance or whatever.
Yeah.
My goodness. And so Jessica goes, oh, wow, I guess love is, like, this really harsh, really awful thing then. It's not about, like, softness and love at all. I'm like, no, don't listen to her.
No. Yeah.
Remember when we were like, here is the, like, rational one.
Uh-huh.
She talks about the plank of Carnides, which is about whether it's, whether if you're drowning with another person in the sea, there's a plank, and if one person reaches for it and then the other person pushes them off the plank, is that murder or self-defense? She was like, I wouldn't hesitate to push someone else off the plank.
Yeah, her basically boils down to, Jessica, I don't know what you're going through, but if you need to kill somebody else for love, you should do it. And I was like, that's convenient. Yeah.
It's like, I will, if I can justify it logically, I'll happily kill someone. It's
oh,
like...
not only that, she also basically says, like, every woman should be in a position where she has to kill someone for love at least once in her life. And I was like, ah! Kyrie, what are you doing? You're so messed up.
And then, Jessica enters kill mode.
Yeah, she goes robo, grey blank eyes, and also, whenever she's moving in this, I don't know, whenever she does anything in this next scene, she makes the Delano guncock noise.
Yeah.
Which is great.
I imagined this, like, in Mission Impossible, where Henry Cavill has to reload his arms. I've never seen that movie, but I really hope Henry Cavill makes the ch-ch-ch noise. It's very satisfying.
I will say this is a slight Higurashi reference. When some characters go a bit murder crazy in Higurashi, their eyes look like Jessica's do in this.
But yeah, she just like launches at the back of Kyrie's head because Kyrie's like, okay, I'm going back now.
Yeah, Kyrie notices it because Kyrie's like, I've always got to be prepared for an attack. And you had 7 reasons for coming to talk to me. You trying to kill me is the worst one.
Yeah, like, she was basically...
seven motivations.
Yeah, Kyrie was basically like, I've used my powers of envy to constantly be paranoid. And because that's a good way to live your life. So I knew you were that it was impossible that you were going to kill me, so I dodged it at the last moment. Also, because she had a really lame excuse for being in the upstairs, apparently.
And so who should come to Kyrie's defense as Jessica upgrades her fists to flame mode? the stake of Envy Leviathan.
Yeah, like, we're going full witch fight again.
Leviathan stabs Jessica in the head. However, because of her pact with the love demons, Jessica is immortal and just puts her fist to her head to, like cauterize and seal the wound.
And it just kind of heals back up, and...
That's metal as fuck, actually.
Yeah. And so she's just standing there, like, occasionally trying to punch Kyrie, and then also doing, being, like, flame upgrade, armor upgrade to all of... to her body and stuff for some reason.
And Jessica invokes the name of Ronove to seal off Kyrie's escapes. So Kyrie can't jump through a window or
leave the corridor or something, is it?
Yeah, she can't get help because Jessica seems to know that if help arrives, the witch powers will dissipate because of the anti-magic toxin.
Mm-hmm.
So Kyrie, Leviathan becomes like a key. I imagine just moving the pins in a lock really quickly with her stake tip. Anyway, to open the door to Krause's study, which Kyrie locks inside. Leviathan's like, this is a coffin. But Kyrie is like, well, to kill me, she'll have to open the lid of the coffin.
Yeah, because they're like, yeah, but she's got flaming hands. This is going to be fine. You've just locked yourself in here.
But then Kyrie uses her envy force field, which slows down Jessica's attacks because Kyrie Because Jessica's envy has only been for as long as 0.2% of Kyrie's envy.
Yeah, like, the envy maths, it's back. Because Leviathan, like, because Kyrie's been envious for a full 18 years. Meanwhile, yeah. Jessica's only been envious for 2 years, because that's when Shannon and George got together. But only when Shannon was actually talking to her about George, which is not very often and stuff. And I'm like...
I hate math.
Yeah.
This is miserable.
Jessica's
trying to punch the door, and, like, her fist just completely slows down every time it's about to hit.
Yeah. Oh, dear. She's fully outside, like, all I want to do, bang, 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 and a ching, and take your money.
That actually really suits this scene.
Can we have an AMV, please?
Sadly, this part of the VN has not been animated, but I'm still down. Jessica gets around this by creating the perfect construction of the closed room inside her head, and upgrades her fists to do an indirect attack, sending flames into Krause's study, and presumably killing Kyrie.
Yeah, she turns her fist into a flamethrower and it goes through the keyhole, is basically what happens. And I don't... It's weird because Ronave basically says, like, ooh, how's she gonna kill her now? Because it's a closed room and only magic can kill someone through a closed room. Jessica doesn't understand magic. And Jessica then goes, flamethrower hand! Boof! And Ronave's like, well, I guess she does understand magic.
Yeah, and Jessica says, if you love the hell of envy so much, then burn.
Yeah.
Which is a metal as fuck line.
It's so good. This was interesting to me, because the way I interpreted this was that Jessica is not actually... Like, this isn't actually what happens, but Jessica still needs to get through the locked room in the human explanation in order to kill Kyrie. So whatever the witch explanation looks like, there will be a human explanation of the locked room that is different, that Jessica figures out in this moment and executes. That was my interpretation of what happened here, and why everyone was so impressed with what went on. It's not because Jessica's like, flame hands through the door, like, that makes sense, we all anticipated this, but that, like, there's a locked room here that Jessica solved, like, in that moment, and then killed Kyrie.
After this, she instructs Ronave to kind of clean up the room so it doesn't look like she did flamethrower mm-hmm. hands.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, yeah, sure. And then we cut back to the lounge. Jessica is no longer in murder mode and is having a bit of a breakdown because she just killed someone.
Yeah.
To be fair, Kyrie did a pretty good job of setting it up so you could feel, like, as least bad as possible for killing her.
I know, like, I was...
Good job for that.
Yeah, she really justified her own death quite nicely.
Yeah, she was like, by the way, I love to kill a sumo. Why do you want to kill me?
Oh, for love. Oh, I see.
Normal.
This was the point where I realised, I was like, if everyone here is proving their love for each other by killing someone, what does it say about each game board where Beatrice kills everyone except Battler? Is that for his sake, to prove her love to him? Like, is that to prove she will kill for him? But, like, he didn't ask her to kill his family.
Episode 1, I was fully like, Beato Battler is a crack ship. Now I'm like, oh, fucking hell. This is main plot line.
Yeah, no, it is. The upshot of this, the end of this scene, is that Canon Shannon and Baby Treche all volunteer to go next at the same time.
Yes, very cute.
They're all like, my turn to kill.
My turn. Because they're all shy. Because they're all the same person.
All three of them.
I did come across a fan theory that was like somebody who'd finished Umen Echo and was like, Canon and Shannon are the same person. That was the title. I did not read any further, but I was like, this is an unhinged take.
New theory, Beatrice is canon with Shannon sitting piggyback style on his back. So Shannon's the face and Canon's the legs.
That's why she has to have that big dress. It's to contain the, like...
Contain the two
pantomime
people.
Horse.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. So, we end with a lovely close-up of Canon, Shannon, and Beatrice as the demons are like, so, who's gonna go next?
Like, me!
And then, who should go next but Canon?
Yes.
Time for Canon versus Rosa!
Yeah, Rosa's in the parlor thinking about Maria's dad.
Yeah, having some Maria's dad thoughts. We haven't had a huge amount on this guy.
No.
But we basically find out that she was, like, she thought she was a pretty, like, she was pretty locked into being his wife.
Yeah.
So she signed this not great loan with him. And then he fucked off. He left the country. She was like, that's great, go have an adventure. And then he just, like, dropped all contact with her, and she's like, fuck, maybe I shouldn't have said that.
Yeah, so he basically was like, I'm gonna go on an adventure, and then when I come back, we'll be together. And then he just ran off with her money and never spoke to her again, and, like, didn't return her calls. The address he'd given her was fake. Like, he's gone.
Insane.
Even though he had Maria with her.
Yeah.
So we get some absolutely wild discourse here. Because they compare, like, having, quote-unquote, not fought, because the title of the chapter is The Fate of Those Who Do Not Fight.
Yeah, they compare... Canon basically turns up and is like, hi, Rosa, I know all about this for some reason. So they talk about it together.
And Rosa's like, this is hell, and this hell I'll regret not fighting what I should have until the day I died. And, like... They're like, yeah, if you in love, if you do not fight, you fall into hell. And some, like, absolutely bonkers, like, proper, like, metal as hell lines here. Like, the truly terrifying thing is the hell into which falls the unsleeping ghosts who cannot win, yet cannot die. And I'm like, that hell has no end. And I'm like, so, I'm so confused here as to, like, what the take is. Like... Okay, so you've got to quote-unquote fight for love. In this game, that's actually murdering people. Wow. But then these people are like, have these people never heard of, like, if you love them, let them free?
No. Like, apparently not.
Honestly, this does not feel like a particularly healthy approach to love from anybody involved.
Not.
Like,
yeah,
you've got Kyrie's version, which is, like, fighting and, like, I would actually murder somebody and, like, I'm going to stew for 18 years in envy. And then Rosa's version where she's like, I'm going to just, like, live in regret forever. And I'm like, none of this is good approach. Like, what
is
going on?
I mean, this is a really interesting parallel to what Battler's going through right now with Beatrice. I think it's...
How do you mean?
It's fascinating. Like, it's like... All three of these characters are having to deal with the fact that, like, or have had to deal with the fact that the person they love is unavailable. Rosa's ran off. Kyrie was married to another woman. And Beatrice is dead, and Battler is having to cope with that.
Yeah.
So I think it's a really interesting way of looking at that by having these three characters' interpretations of what is happening and how they choose to deal with it. Rosa clearly is taking out her resentments on Maria.
Yeah.
She says that Maria growing up is painful because it reminds her of Maria's father.
Yeah.
Who I think, again, is purposefully not named in this moment.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's on purpose. I don't know. It's weird. They're like Rosa's version of love. Like, Rosa's actions aren't good. But then, they're like, off the back of this, they're like, okay, so what actually are they advocating for here? Because I don't know that they're necessarily advocating for Kyrie's method, even though it's like, oh, Kyrie was made powerful by this method and almost managed to defeat Jessica. They're like, you've got to give it a shot and pull it put it all on the line. Dying in battle is better than the alternative. And I'm like, is it? Is it?
It's
for
not,
one, this is a super monogamous version of love. So I'm like, okay, like, I feel like this is quite restrictive, but also, like, this feels really unhealthy. Maggie Nelson in The Argonauts talks about, like, the ultimate, like, surrender to somebody being, like, falling forever. And there is a part of that here. It's like, you're completely surrendering to somebody, you're like falling forever, you're allowing yourself to just completely let go, as one does in as Maggie Nelson compares it to grief, childbirth and orgasm are all times where you just like completely let yourself go. I also feel this when I listen to Bury the Light, but yeah, no, it's like, yes, this is a type of love. But having to sacrifice yourself like that for somebody, particularly somebody who, for example, in Rose's case, is like horribly abusive, is like not necessarily the wisest thing to do. And it's not a thing that you
Rosa
just
clearly,
like.
I think what's interesting about Rose's case is I see her view on this relationship as inherently warped.
Yeah.
Because if this man was really willing to abandon her, it doesn't matter what she would have said there.
Yeah, exactly. Like, she regrets letting him go overseas because she sees that as the place where if she'd fought and said, no, you stay with me, that she'd have been able to lock him down. And I'm like, given everything we know about this man, that would have not worked.
No.
That would have not worked.
No, that's true.
That's the whole thing. Rose's like own understanding of this relationship is informed by her own low self-esteem. We've established several times in this VN that Rosa kind of hates herself. And takes it out by trying, like a lot of characters in this VN do, by abusing those she sees as weaker than her, like, as a way of letting out her own insecurities.
I often say, love is somebody that you would do anything for. True love is somebody who will never ask you to. Like, these people are talking about, like, oh, sacrificing everything for love. And I'm like, you shouldn't have to do that. You should be able to trust somebody unconditionally, fall forever. But you should not have to, like, you should not have to be, like, every second of the day, like, I'm just going to put my reservations aside and trust you. Like, you should be able to do both.
Well,
yeah, I think it's interesting in this because I think I very much, for a start, I don't trust Zeppar and Furfur's ideal of whatever love is, because they feel like a suitable way of proving love is to kill somebody. So I'm like, already all of the kind of things that they have to say about love, I don't trust. Because this is clearly coming from a really odd place. And yeah, it's making love into this thing, like with like Kyrie said, where it's really harsh and brutal and it's all about suffering and doing the worst things possible to kind of lock down and possess the person that you love. I don't know where that's going, but I'm presuming that it will, like, that there will be an alternative.
Yeah.
Better version at some point presented.
I would like that. It's interesting that there's all these complicated discussions, but I want to know what will get validated by the narrative.
We gotta read more.
What I think is just interesting is every time they talk about fighting for love, it's always paralleled against the fact that, like, that's what the other characters are literally doing.
Yeah.
Like, that's what I find most interesting about this reading is all these discussions about kind of metaphorically fighting for love. As Cheryl Cole, sorry, just Cheryl, once said, we gotta fight for this love. So I think it's a really interesting discussion. Anyway, Cannon stabs Rosa with his red energy blade.
Yes.
Yeah, and she doesn't notice for a good few seconds until she starts bleeding into her teacup.
He's just like, go have a nap. Go, like, lie down.
Go lie down and puts a blanket over her dead corpse. I think this is interesting, actually. I don't know whether this will... It'll probably be elaborated on when we actually go over the first Twilight, but the last thing she does before she dies is she picks up a cup of tea, and I'm like, I'm one, and the, it does say that although Canon uses his blade to like kill her, it doesn't, there are no actual wounds on her body, so I'm like, is this a poisoning in the human explanation? Possible.
That's interesting. I'm suddenly wondering what bearing the other deaths would have on the method of killing, because if Rosa gets poisoned because of like the things that you've just said here, it, like, how does Kyrie die in the human explanation?
I'll have to look at her body, I suspect.
Maria comes in and is like, you just fucking killed my mother. Yes, I had a complicated relationship with her, but also that's my mother.
Yeah. She's understandably quite upset.
Not my daughter, you bitch.
Not my daughter, you bitch. Not my mother, you slut! Maria summons Sakutaro to use his diplomatic immunity to stop Canon from having an energy sword.
Yeah, because Canon literally says in this moment, he goes like, I don't want to kill another person, but if I have to, I will. Because he's like, if he knows that if he dies in that scenario, if Maria kills him, he'll be out of the love game. So he's prepared to kill her as well to basically get out.
Yeah.
But his sword keeps dissolving.
Oh no! You know, it does happen to 1 in 3 people. It's a perfectly normal thing, and it's okay.
Don't like that.
So it's just nervousness, drunkenness. It's all right. There are other things you can do. It's not a magic wand.
Maria's prepping to kill him. But who should show up to block the shots? But Shannon!
Yes!
He's back with another barrier.
Yes. So the reason why Canon can't kill Maria is because Sakutaru invokes diplomatic immunity.
Of the mariage sorcière. Blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. So Canon's like ineffective, but Shannon, because she has a defensive ability, can still use her ability, and I'm like, oh my god, girl boss.
Shannon has such amazing, huge, bouncy barriers.
Yes. So earlier, Maria had like fully like sealed off the room so that Canon could escape.
Yeah.
However, when Shannon starts using her barrier, she keeps expanding the barrier. Bouncy barrier to basically push Maria and Sakutaro against the wall, and because like the wall can't break because it's a fully sealed off closed room, they just get crushed between the barrier and the wall.
Yeah, Shannon kind of, there's a moment just before they die where kind of Shannon kind of essentially says like, is this okay? I'm gonna kill you now. That's okay, right? And Maria's like, yeah, go on.
Yeah, Maria's like, this will really stump that horrible detective.
Yeah.
Which is Maria's down.
Which is interesting. I'm like, Shannon always asks for consent before murdering somebody.
I had two main feelings about this section. The first one is we had previously been like, this is gonna be Maria episode, and it's like immediately not
and now
again.
She's dead.
And I'm like, fuck! I was excited for Maria versus Erica content.
You can't kill her in the first Twilight again. However, we have seen, obviously, like, we've seen actually a lot more of Witch Maria than we have seen of Peace Maria in this episode so far. So I'm not gonna discount her, because she might come back as like, in the meta world only to fight Erica there,
yeah.
Maybe?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Also, we have gotten a lot of Maria content. It's just all, like, front-loaded, and now we won't get any more, and I'm like, oh, okay. The second one I thought is, I'm going to give credit where credit's due. When we first, in, like, episode 2 or something, saw Canon and Shannon's powers, I was like, ugh, it's so typical that a woman is given, like, a defensive power, and we were like, haha, big bouncy barriers and stuff. And, like, I still feel that way a little bit, but it was really cute here, the, like, little turning of that on its head, where actually Canon was completely useless, and Shannon was, like, useful because of her defensive nature. And I was like, feminism.
Yeah.
Not proper feminist, not, but you know what I mean. I was like, this is fun. So I am like, shout out to Ryakishi for this fun little like play on the trope. I wouldn't say it's a true upending, and I wouldn't say it's truly innovative.
I do think their powers are purposeful. I just don't know if I want to elaborate more at this point in time.
That's fair. So I just
we'll
wanted
save
to
this discussion for another day.
Yeah, I just wanted to like. I had liked this, and it's very rare that I like something in Umineko, and so I wanted to like call it when I saw it, because that's only fair. I'm really mean about this game.
So now we get a final battle
between
Natsuhi and Natsuhi.
Yeah, so Canon and Shannon have done their murders, and now it's Baby Triche's turn.
Yes.
Yes, Baby Triche is taking on her biggest threat yet of Natsuhi.
Who she does choose.
She does choose. She chooses Natsuhi specifically because of the last game and says that, basically talks about the theory that Natsuhi, like, almost killed Battler as a baby. And
yeah, it was like, she's like, I don't know if it's true, but if it is true, then been a terrible person to Battler, so I'll kill her.
Well, if she's got to pick a target, this is a decent enough way to pick a target. It's better than Jessica.
I will say, I think it's interesting that of the murders that we see, it's all the Ushirimiya family women, except for Jessica, who end up being dead.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, like, I was thinking, like, when Shannon came up, I was like, Shannon, you're not going to kill Maria, are you? You're not going to do this to me. You can't do this to me. Basically, the only way that I accepted this was because it was essentially self-defense for Canon.
Yeah, that is why
because
I think
if Shannon had just gone and killed Maria normally, I'd have been like, how dare you? but I do wish it was someone else.
Battler Jessica loves violence against women, what can I say?
Natsuhi is looking at herself in a mirror that she got as a wedding present. It's the spirit mirror from episode 2, if you guys can remember that. And she's looking at her own face and thinking about how she resembles her parents and grandparents more as she grows older. How she misses her old family, who she completely had to cut ties with.
And she wants to help Kraus and support him, but she feels like the only way she can do that is by not being with him, because he doesn't actually appreciate her.
And then Baby Triche shows up, and Natsuhi takes a while to figure out who she is, which is really funny. She lives in a house with a giant portrait of this woman, literally, like...
You're like, who the fuck are you?
In the hallway. I was like, how do you not recognize immediately that this white woman in your home is the same as the white woman in your hallway? Baby Triche is like, sorry, gotta kill you, and starts like force choking her.
Yes,
I wrote that.
But then Natsuhi, kind of like she drops the spirit mirror, but like it flashes at Baby Triche, and Baby Triche has to stop.
Yeah,
and turns out even though Baby Triche is not weak to a bunch of the other stuff that Elder Triche was, she is weak to the spirit mirror. They can't seem to quite work out why.
Yeah.
But Natsuhi is like fully weaponizing this to defend herself, basically. And she's going to go call more people and use the toxin to stop this attack.
I took this as by showing Beatrice her reflection, she sees who she truly is. Brackets Shannon.
Yeah, I was wondering that. Is it specifically about the fact it's a mirror rather than that it's anything to do with any mystical powers or stuff? It's just that she doesn't want to see
the fact that it's actually Shannon.
Why wouldn't she want to see that she's Shannon?
Because she's currently going Beato mode. You know when you think your outfit's really good and you're walking through a shopping centre and you catch it at completely the wrong angle and you're like, actually, I fucking hate myself. She just doesn't want that emotion.
It's definitely impossible.
I want to talk about my explanation, my interpretation of the scene, but I can't.
No!
know that I have a really, like, really interesting and unique take. Well, it's not unique. A really interesting take, but I can't talk about
it. We're going to have, like, 7 million episodes at the end where Courtney tells us all of her different takes about Umineko that she couldn't say throughout.
Especially in this reading, there are so many lovely little details that I really want to talk about,
mm-hmm.
but I cannot.
Well, you better be writing them down for later.
I've been DMing them to my Umineko friends throughout, like, while I've been reading, doing this reading. Like, I've just been here like, this bit's so cool, I love Ryukishi when he does this. So who should show up to Baby Trichet's defense but the stake Lucifer, who knocks the mirror out of Natsuhi's hand. Lucifer's like, God, I haven't done anything for ages. You make me show up to, like, get rid of a mirror? Ugh, this sucks. So that's fun.
And then that's how he tries to go for the door, but then Baby Trichet's like, oh, I'm gonna choke you again.
Yes. Yeah, and she almost loses the fight.
Yeah.
Yes. Because Natsuhi nearly manages to get out the door, and, you know, the toxin
that would break the closed room seal, break everything. So Lucifer's the one who finishes her in the end, isn't it?
Yeah, Lucifer is instructed by Battler screen to finish off Natsuhi.
Yeah,
Love Demons are like, does this count? And they go, because it's an act of true love.
Yeah, because it was Battler who did it. I got confused in this scene because I didn't originally understand that Lucifer had anything to do with Battler. So I was like, I thought that Baby Trichet had summoned Lucifer. So they were like, she didn't do it herself though, did she? I was like, well, she kind of did. But yeah, then Battler turns up and is like, hey, yo, I helped. What's this game then?
Regal Battler does kind of slap. I'm really sorry. I did enjoy him in this scene where he's being all like regal but tender, and I'm like, oh, this
yeah,
does go
he's
hard.
Yeah, he's changed his tune.
Yeah.
Yeah, clearly the conversations he's had with himself, I guess, that we saw have helped him kind of soften a bit more.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he's being nice, and he says Baby Trichet can call him what she wants.
Yeah.
And she actually seems to settle on Battler-san rather than father, which is so much better.
Yeah, and he does say that he's pleased she didn't settle on father, because he said it was a bit weird.
Yeah, there's a whole section here that's a bit weird, where Baby Trichet's like, I love him. And I'm like, this is her gaining her Beato bit back, where she's like the version of Beato who, like, did love Battler, etc., etc. But also, like, because she's been calling him father, it just, oh, it did not sit well with me. I was just like, I can't tell whether this is, like, love brackets familial or love brackets horny, and this feels weird.
I think the relationship that Battler has with Baby Trichet is complicated on many angles.
Yeah. What confused me the most about this scene is that Battler basically turns up and goes, oh yeah, I was told there was some kind of love game going on. What's this? Can I be involved? I'm like, of course there is, Battler. You made it. You're the game master.
So, yeah.
I'm not entirely sure what he's doing with all of this, because, like, he's acting like he doesn't know about any of it, but I'm like, you had to make this. Like, this is your story.
He's pretending like he's not in control of some of these pieces, and I'm like, you're totally in control of Baby Trichet.
Yeah, like, so I'm curious to see where he's going with any of that. Also, they say, like, and also they're like, oh, Battler, if you want to join in, you've got to kill someone too. He's like, oh, I already did it. Off screen. I'll show you later.
Yeah.
And I was like,
I'm assuming that's
like,
Jessica. Complete the set.
And I'm also like, well, of course he did, because, like, he's orchestrated all of these murders so far. But also, like, he knew that he'd have to. And also, that makes 6 murders. So that's the first Twilight then.
Yeah.
So, like, yeah, it's all part of, like, the love game is all part of his witch explanation for the murders. That has to have been something he created.
Yes.
What does he gain from pretending like he doesn't know what's going on?
Yeah.
Is that a trick for Baby Tree Chay, maybe?
Hmm.
Her benefit? Mm. I don't know.
Well, yeah, he's handily prepared a murder earlier.
Yes. So
that's all good.
He blue-petered this one.
So, yeah. And we cut away from the trial to our last part of this reading, which is Ange talking to Toya Hachijo.
Yeah, so this is the real world. This is not Featherine and Ange. This is the author Ange and Amakusa, Jill Genderman.
Yeah, more boy.
And Ange and... Yeah, and they're doing some literary analysis, and Ryukishi is once again turning to the camera and going, hey, you like visual novels?
Anger's like, I don't get it, because it's all about love. Everything's all about love, but the love is obscuring the fact that 6 people have just been killed. Why is it all about love all the time? And I'm like,
yeah.
Well, that's the theme. I don't know what the theme is meaning, though.
That Hachida's basically says, I did this on purpose.
Yeah.
Just because it's not the details about a murder doesn't mean it's not important to the story I'm trying to tell. Yeah. Which is kind of what I imagine Ryukishi wants the audience to take away from this.
And
as well.
Anja also goes, like, even though I don't, like Hachijo goes, I'm doing this because you don't know the truth behind it all. And Anja's like, yeah, there's something I don't get, and I don't know why it's all got to do with love, but I do feel like this episode fits with the others, like it's a true Birto story basically.
She says something about like having unlocked the truth of the game or whatever, which I think they've talked about before, and then she turns to Ange and she's like, if you unlocked the truth of the game, you'd like be the true successor of the Yushiromiya family. And I'm like, more themes. Themes for Owen. More themes. Successor. Successor. You said the word. I'm right. Huh?
Yeah. I want to I'm being bashed over the head with the answer, and I wish I knew what it was.
You're like, ow, that really hurts. What the fuck are you hitting me with?
What is it?
Ow, Ryukishi, stop hitting me.
Not in that voice, actually.
I think this reading in general has a lot of very nice hints and setup in it. So
I kept imagining in my head that the next sentence I read, I'd have this big epiphany where everything would fall into place and I'd get it. And I was so looking forward to that feeling of it happening. And that's been like the past like 4 readings for me, and it just hasn't happened.
Oh dear.
I think. I'm hoping that what this episode at least does is, even if you don't read this and, like, it doesn't all click for you, at least when it is revealed by the narrative, you go, was actually, like, set up.
Yeah.
You know?
I feel like we've talked about all of it enough that, like, we're engaging with it, even if we're not understanding it, so that when it does reveal, we'll see all of the bits.
I think you guys have definitely caught on to, like, the themes that, like, are trying to be conveyed, which is good. It's pretty... They're not hard themes to grasp, but I'm glad that you've clicked with them, I guess. It'd be really weird if you turned around
and... magic and child abuse.
This is all about just wasting time until we kill someone. I'm like, I'm glad that's not been your takeaway from this is
a story about murder.
Yeah, you're not like, where's the murder? Which is exactly what Erica does in the next scene.
Yeah, I am kind of like that, though, because they are my favourite bits of when the deaths happen and I try and work it out. But I know that that's not the point of the book.
But you're not like, this is all useless fluff.
No.
You're like, you do know that this is trying to actually convey something.
Yeah, literally at the end, the last thing that happens in this chapter is Erica's like, oh god, that was boring, when are we doing the murders? And Battle's like, right now. it's like I enjoy the murders and I enjoy working out the individual murders because I like the puzzle aspect of it, but like I know that the actual truth of Umaneko, I think, can only be solved with all of this extra stuff that Erica finds boring. I think.
Yeah. Yeah, sorry, Erica, you're not right about this one. We need the
sorry,
weird
Bessie.
Love chip.
Oh. Yeah. The weird love, without the weird love shit, it can't be seen.
It would be interesting if, like, there's any love story in Umineko that, like, ends up being unproblematic and uncomplicated at any point. I don't think they will.
That
be.
Sure would be interesting, wouldn't it?
Because, like, it's not Shannon and George. It's not Jessica and Cannon. I really don't feel like Beato Battler is going to be uncomplicated and unproblematic, you know?
Clearly, the unproblematic version is Beato Kinzo.
Yeah. The only Maybe. True love is between Maria and her stuffed animals.
It's true. It's true.
There's not even unproblematic parental love.
No,
Ange Leviathan. Is it Leviathan? Ange and that one of the states.
No, it's Mammon.
Yeah, Ange Mammon.
One of them is a literal demon, but it's fine.
But
she's also literally imaginary at the same time. So.
Ange and her
that
imaginary
kind of rules
girlfriend.
Out only a demon for me.
Ange is like, I'm so lonely. What if I made up a girlfriend?
And she's right.
And then what if I made up seven girlfriends?
And a lion boy.
And a lion boy. Me and my polycule and our singular son.
Yeah. So, that's the end of the reading. Do we have any closing thoughts?
Umineko is the only book in which I would know in depth multiple people's opinions on things such as the holiday Halloween, like different types of candy, cheating on tests, but still not have a gender or pronouns for one of the major characters, or like several of the major characters.
Yes, where's my Zephyr for gender reveal?
when are we gonna get their cards posted, like just an actual link to their cards, they say it in, and so we can see
I need their blood type
are. And also what don't follow unless or don't follow if
DNI
list.
Listen, this is the thing, I'm like, this book is 150 hours long. It can afford to not be economical on, like, important things like the genders of these characters. Because it would be such a fucking slay if the book turned around and was like, Zeppar is non-binary and goes by, like, they, he, or something. I would be like, this is awesome.
I think because of how pronouns work in Japanese, it wouldn't quite be like that.
I'm aware of that, but, like, you know what I mean. Like, it doesn't have to be obscure about it. There is space for it to do that. It would be a massive slay if it did, and it doesn't, and I'm sad about that.
Not
come
yet.
On, come on, Ryukishi.
I suppose Zephyr and Furfa are more utilities than characters.
Yeah, I just... Like, come on. This is... You don't need to, it sucks that Ryukishi is, instead of, like, doing actually trans characters, is just dancing around the topic and being obscure, and the point I was just gonna make is, like, gender reveal? Come on. Like, you've got 150 hours of this fucking book, you can put it in there.
Give to me.
I will say, given stuff that happens later, I feel like Ryukishi makes up for this.
I'll allow that. I just, yeah.
Me when we get there, but in my opinion, I feel that the time that could have been spent exploring Zephyr and Furfur is used better elsewhere.
Yeah.
They don't really get any character explanation at all.
I do want to know Zephyr's pronouns so that I can correctly gender my waifu.
Yeah. It is what it is. I just simply that's my after all of this discussion, that is my takeaway, of course.
Your takeaway is, where's the Zeppar and Ferpa spinoff?
Ryukishi should literally be yelling trans rights every episode, otherwise it's not a good book.
You're right, what all books would be improved by this.
Every book chapter should begin with trans rights.
What's your favourite literary work that does this?
What's my favourite literary work that does that?
We don't have favourite books. They don't exist.
No, as in, like, you know, what would you say is your favourite that just keeps yelling trans rights?
Becky Chambers, A Close and Common Orbit.
Thank you. I will.
There is in that book series. There's a character who literally uses.
I believe.
I can't remember, but in that book series, there is literally a character who uses neo pronouns.
The first one is called A Long Journey to a Small Angry Planet.
Yes.
I've not read the second one, but the first one's really good.
We'll add that to the official Hidden Tea Party reading.
Trans rights book. I mean, like, also, for all its problematicism, you've got Ursula Le Guin's Left Hand of Darkness, which is also, like, a book mostly about people, like, not really existing with the concept of gender. The follow-up essay that she did, which is one of my favourite things, because Ursula Le Guin turned around and said, hey, I would have dealt with some of these topics differently later on, and here's how I would have changed it, and I'm like, fuck yeah, learning and growing as a person, it is one of my favourite fucking things that people do, and I'm like screaming and yelling.
Stuff like that. So, I'd be like, actually, you know
what?
I will say this.
When I say I don't think someone transphobic could read, understand, and enjoy Umineko, Echo, I'm not referring to Zeppar and Ferfa.
I just
want you to know that when I say that, I'm not saying because I think Zeppar and Ferfa are amazing LGBT representation. Yeah. I don't really think about Zeppar and Ferfa that much.
Yeah.
Pity, I'm thinking about them every single day.
I'm thinking about the fact that when they do this, one of their sprites, they have their hands out a lot to the sides, but the hand that's kind of like down, it makes it look like they're holding hands in the middle.
I fucking love when that happens. I love when you see two people walking down the street and it's like two lads and they're walking slightly too close together, and so for a second you're like, are you holding hands? It's my favourite thing. I love humans. That's why I don't like Umineko. There's too many witches and furniture.
Rowan loves humans.
I can't believe you'd say you loved humans when the Ushuramias exist.
Oh god, I'm cancelled.
You love Kinzo? Oh my god.
Maybe a little.
As a treat.
As a treat. Nanjo's a human.
Nanjo is a human.
Nanjo is in fact a human. And he didn't, in fact, have sex with Kinzo.
Or did he?
Listen to our Christmas episode.
Listen to our Christmas episode. It was beautiful.
Speaking of episodes that are dropping, I think now is the time where I talk about what we're reading next week.
Yes.
So, we are reading from chapter 12, About the Crime Scene, to chapter 14, A Small Contradiction.
Yes. Okay, Drive exciting.
I like
A Small Contradiction.
Scene.
Yes, I thought you'd hear that title and go, so enjoy that. It's a good reading, in my opinion. Lots of good Erica content. Come on, you knew it was going to be.
It's in the real world, of course. It's an Erica content. Yeah,
we're still sorting out stuff with our Twitter as of the time of recording, but check the description for potential pod Twitter. Pod Tumblr's still up and thriving. Thank you, Jess, for running that as always. And our personal Twitters are in the description. So, on that wonderful note, thank you and good night.
Bye, guys.